in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Dwayne Olson, a retired member of the teacher education faculty at UW-Parkside, Karen Sconsert, an associate professor of education at Carthage College, Mike Kehoe, a retired substitute teacher and a current special education support volunteer at Bullen Middle School in Kenosha, and Chuck Wolbers, a transition and work experience teacher in the special education department at Tremper High School, also in Kenosha. Now, here is today's Education Matters moderator.
Good morning. I'm Dwayne Olson, your host today for Education Matters on WGTD-HD, Gateway Technical College, Kenosha, Wisconsin, at 91.1 on your FM dial, and 101.7 in Elkhorn and 103.3 in Lake Geneva. WGTD is a member of the Wisconsin Public Radio Network. Today's guest is Professor Todd Allen Price, Director of Policy Studies and Program Chair for Educational Foundations and Inquiry at the Wheeling, Illinois campus of National Lewis University. Dr. Price lives here in Kenosha and holds his PhD from UW-Madison. Dr. Price has been a guest on Education Matters several times before, so welcome back, Todd. It's good to have you with me today. Todd is one of those people that I turn to provide the bigger picture on contemporary American education and especially public education. As we open the new year, and a very important year it is, as this is a presidential election year and our current U.S. Secretary of Education has indicated that he is stepping down shortly. As a result, it is even more important that we understand where we are and the possibilities for the future in terms of American public education. First of all, let's get a little more background on you, Professor Price. Briefly tell our listeners about your recent activities at National Lewis University, your teaching, your administrative activities, and so on. Okay?
Well, thanks. It's great to be back, Dwayne. There's so many things to talk about the educational front, and this is a deliberative venue, which makes it nice to have this conversation with you. Right now, the big change, I suppose, and it's more of a continuation of what I've been doing, but I've been elected to a board, which is a governance and advocacy board for the American Association of Colleges of Teacher Education.
ACTE.
Yes, which means that I'll be able to do more of what I've been doing in an official capacity, which is lobbying Congress a little bit.
Good.
And putting out some ideas that are in the benefit of students, of course, and teachers everywhere. So that starts in February, and I continue with my work as the Director of Policy Studies and teaching a couple courses that relate to educational policy.
Okay, and you told me that just yesterday you were with a group of faculty members interviewing potential candidates.
Yes.
For PhD programs.
Yes, we have a program, and I don't mind promoting it here in Kenosha because there would be great to get some Wisconsiners in this area too, Curriculum Advocacy and Policy.
Uh-huh.
And the coursework generally is studying curriculum. We have foundational courses that look at psychology, epistemology, and a number of areas of interest for educational leaders.
Uh-huh.
So yesterday, the fun thing I get to do is interview potential candidates with my colleagues who are all over the world right now. We had a couple folks in Israel, and my good colleague Dr. Rashid is in Ghana, and we brought all these folks together to have some conversations about the achievement gap. That was what we discussed.
Oh, really?
Yes. So we did that, and that's part of a fun exercise is to work with our potential students.
Well, in that way, like discussing a topic like that with these potential candidates for PhDs then gives you a sense for what their broader understanding of the issues facing American public education or American education, K-12?
Absolutely. These folks are actually going for what's called an ED, which is an educational doctorate. So it's a bit more focused on the practitioner leader.
Okay.
And what they do is they read an article, and I know you're familiar, Dwayne, because you're a scholar too, with Linda Darling Hammond's work talking about closing the teaching gap.
Yes.
So they read this article, and they discussed it with us, and then we have them write and do an exercise.
Oh, she's one of my favorite writers. Anytime I see something by Linda Darling Hammond, I usually stop and print it off because I know she's got something important to say.
Very much so.
Okay, let's go on then to our next question. Before we get into the new federal law governing public education, ESSA, and I like what that stands for, Every Student Succeeds Act 2015. Well, remind our listeners of the major points of the previous law, which was known as No Child Left Behind 2002. What were some of the major points of that?
So there are several points, but the premise behind NCLB was that every child deserved an excellent school and that we should assess every child to see what progress they're making, that all schools should be excellent schools, and we should have highly qualified teachers. There are a number of these general themes that are maintained in what folks are, I gather, are calling ESSA, or the Every Student Succeeds Act. And then there are some dramatic changes as well. To my thinking, the intention from several educators in the NCLB era was to make sure that every child was indeed being monitored, evaluated, and assessed. And I think that was a good intention. I think the unfortunate, unintended consequence was that we created a testing culture,
yes,
which let's say, and I will say this very diplomatically because there's so many different opinions on this, but largely incentivize teaching to the test.
Yes.
And that's unfortunate because and it could have really been expected. If you put so much pressure on these testing scores,
yes,
you're going to create what I've called in a few publications that I'd be happy to share, what you create is an audit culture rather than a learning culture.
Yes.
So that was the unfortunate legacy of No Child Left Behind. There are many other areas as well, but the enduring legacy was that a lot of states, as we saw during the Obama administration, were trying to opt out of that by seeking waivers,
yes,
from the Department of Education. And that also created another challenge that was highly rejected by the Congress under, to be real specific, under Republican control, because the Republican Party very almost unanimously was criticizing the Department of Education,
yes,
for overreaching or overstepping or becoming too intrusive into public schools, which, after all, are supposed to be under local control. And we can talk a lot
and,
about that.
Right, and the responsibility of the state and then to local control, yes.
And the issue is that there's all kinds of different challenges here. The remaining ethic is of, I think it's indicative of our times, is that public schools, as we've talked about previously, are really open to the whole world because there's this notion of global competition. How are kids in America going to be able to stack up against kids in India and China? Years ago, as you recall too, and I both,
yes,
recall, with Nation at Risk and the era of schools are responsible for the growth of the economy, that type of value system was embedded. And that one still maintains, whether it's Goals 2000 then, No Child Left Behind, only about a month ago, and today with Every Student Succeeds Act. And I'm concerned about that particular ethic, not that we don't want to be able to put out kids that are college and career ready. That's the Obama administration's favorite phrase. But the single focus on the competition still concerns me throughout all of this.
Well, and one of the things that you made me think of as you were talking here is this competition and that the schools were responsible for the state of the economy in our country. And so when the economy did get good, the schools didn't get any direct benefit from that, which is kind of ironic, you know. And actually, then educators would say that the educators are not directly responsible for the state of the economy.
This draws a very important distinction.
Yes.
One that begs the question of what do we mean by economic opportunity? And my supposition has always been that certainly preparing children to become young adults who are able to take advantage of the economic opportunities out there is a vital,
yes,
and important and valuable. However, there seems to be a muddying of what that means in terms of the schools actually building an economy. That just doesn't happen. Schools are only one part.
Yes.
They're actually part of an economy.
A very important part.
An important part,
oh, yes,
nonetheless. But the idea that the schools and teachers and principals somehow have a relationship to whether we have enough jobs or whether we're able to produce other widgets or other, build the gross domestic product is really flawed because,
yes,
of course, the government industry has a much, much greater role, yeah, in that regard. So my supposition is it's not a causation, but it's more of a correlation. Yeah. And our statistics folks out there would certainly appreciate what the difference is between those two. I hope our politicians would talk more about that. It's related, but it's not a causal factor.
Yes. Okay. Should we go on then to the new law? We have now a new federal education law that was recently passed by both houses of Congress, and that certainly is an accomplishment,
yes,
you know, and signed into law by President Obama. You called it a compromise bill in one of your emails to me. What are the major elements of that law as they impact America's public schools, Wisconsin's public schools, so on?
Sure, sure. So the first part I wanted to focus on was this issue of the compromise.
Sure.
And what I think was really vital and important for folks from all political stripes to appreciate was how this was reauthorized and what was done. We have to keep in mind first that the No Child Left Behind law has been stuck for about 8 years. It was up for reauthorization well back in 2007.
Yes.
So this is a remarkable victory for a bipartisan piece of legislation moving through what we have to acknowledge has been one of the more feckless Congresses that we have had in the history,
yes,
of our nation,
yes,
where there is so much partisanship and so much log jams to moving forward. I applauded just getting some legislation through, even if I don't,
do too.
Right? Even though I don't agree with every last piece of,
yeah,
it, I just thought it was remarkable because just imagine, Dwayne, if you will, if we could address issues like immigration, gun,
yes,
control issues, health care in the same manner that this legislation went through, we would be demonstrably moving the needle farther towards what the American people need. For that very reason, it was very important to look at.
So it sets a precedent in a sense.
It does. And one of those precedents was drawn by one of our own officials, Senator Tammy Baldwin, noted in the bipartisan hearing chaired by Lamar Alexander and Patty Murray that this was a conference. And conferencing is the way that business used to get done in Washington, but has been so infrequent and rare. So by conferencing,
yeah,
hopefully our viewers can appreciate this, it means that both sides get together. They consent on the bigger picture, move that off the table so that they can deal with those nitty-gritty details. It's a wonderful way to do legislation. We don't do that very often, and it's why we don't have these other bills. So that's the educational piece that is really important in moving this forward. Subsequent to that, there were a number of different issues, and moving right into them, there are a couple major. We'll start with what was saved or what,
yes,
was kept. One thing in my field that is really important is a teacher quality partnership.
Okay.
It's basically a modest amount of money, but it's money that is available to teacher education institutions to do residencies, induction with their teacher candidates. What that means is that we have some grants that support research, that the grants that support trying to improve the teaching in the field. So that was very good. That was included in the Senate. It was going to be taken out of the House version, but the Senate version won. So that was really on our eyesight.
So that's one of those things, too, that you referred to, I think, very favorably to National Lewis University as a fitting,
yes,
in with your goals and what you're trying to do as an organization.
Absolutely. And I think in several of our universities, there is this sentiment that working with we call them teacher candidates in the field at the point of contact where they're working in their classrooms is beneficial to all so that,
okay,
we see how the theory is impacting the practice. So that was very good. There was really pretty much maintenance of the idea that we continue to have the students tested from grades 3 through 8 and once in high school. That's staying the same. What is different is the quote-unquote flexibility related to how locally selected high school assessments and innovative assessment systems operate. Okay, this is straight from the DOE. The DOE, Department of Education, has been interested in that flexibility piece, and that is growing in this particular law. Eliminating, let's talk about just real quickly three eliminations. The NCLB waivers, of course, are gone because we have no NCLB. We have what was called the highly qualified teacher.
Yes.
Which was controversial in the sense that it suggested this particular, perhaps this is overstated, but one particular one-size-fits-all teacher across the country.
Yes.
That everybody would hit that mark and then they would be highly qualified to teach.
Yeah.
You can understand it was kind of a simple concept, actually, but it probably caused more problems than it helped.
And didn't they evaluate teachers in terms of students' test scores?
Yes.
On tests that they would take? And if the test scores were low, obviously that meant the teacher was not capable.
Well, yes, and there were some common sense pieces, though, for example, like subject matter expertise, that a particular teacher knew what she or he was teaching in terms of had an expertise in their field, which I strongly support. I think that's very important. But the other issue was, and the big one, really is adequate yearly progress is gone. So that was what was literally in the corner of the school report cards. It said that, continuing to improve or academic watch, or it had a label by every state and every school and every school district was placed under this report card. And subsequent to that, if you were found lacking, according to adequate yearly progress, the clock was ticking, meaning that if you didn't demonstrably move towards proficient, as you remember, the big nomenclature of No Child Left Behind was every child at grade level by 2014, right?
Yes,
and that's
exactly.
Come and gone. We're already in 2016 now, right? So that didn't happen. But the AYP appeared to, while shedding some light perhaps in what's happening or not happening in a school district, or state, it was too narrow a band in terms of using these standardized tests. It didn't really tell you what the students knew and what they didn't know and where the teacher should reinvest her efforts, because the teacher is getting the information back well after the students have already left into another grade. And so really there's a role for standardized testing.
Yes, exactly.
But it's only one part of the testing. And so AYP was heavily steeped in one band of the testing. And subsequently, that is gone, but now this is verbatim from the Department of Education. They're having a hearing about this next week in Washington, D.C., that viewers can follow on online. It'll be video streamed, so if anybody wants to follow up. They're replacing it with a requirement for each state educational agency, whether that's in our state, of course, as Department of Public Instruction, other states as a Board of Education, but for each agency to develop an accountability system. So the states, and then there's many details, but the states still are required to have an evaluation system. The flexibility is that they have great latitude. In fact, entirely it's up to them to come up with that system.
Yes.
The federal government only has oversight. They can't prescribe what that system is. Hopefully that makes sense. I know the devil's in the details here, but those are rather significant implications when you're in the field as a principal or a local education agency agent.
Okay, and so that response then to this legislation then can be either at the very basic level or at a very complex level, depending on what the state is able to.
That's a great summary. Yes. Yeah. One of the things about No Child Left Behind, and I think we still have to talk about it back and forth, because there were states that opted out of No Child Left Behind before.
Yes.
As I recall, initially Utah and Virginia were saying, well, we don't want the federal money. And that's an interesting concept, because some states are wholly beholden to the federal money. They couldn't really opt out. They needed that money. Now, just to your point, it's going to be even more flexible in terms of how states interpret or how states define what is an accountability system.
Okay. Well, I think let's go on and talk about Common Core, because that fits into what is discussed in terms of contemporary American education, too. And it really should be present, I guess, in all school districts across the country. So one of our biggest recent issues then is Common Core, these academic standards. First of all, tell our listeners briefly about these standards, and then we'll go on from there.
So the standards evolved really from the National Governors Association. They evolved from the chief school officers across the country, meaning like yes. our folks at in Wisconsin and Illinois. And they're broadly conceived by, there's a lot of debate about this, and it's still hard for me to narrow in. It's basically the idea out of outcomes-based education, which is that you define these set of standards that are backwards designed from students who are successful in college or students who are successful in life, in their career.
Yes.
And then you translate those standards – I'm giving you the big theory here – into the schools.
Yes.
So in other words, we're looking at how college students in 2016 are doing, and we try to backwards map that into the curriculum all the way down to my kids who are in first grade and
elementary
fourth grade.
Grades, yes.
Right? You follow? So that's the broader theme. Part of the idea there is that you are trying to make the standards more the aim, but the pedagogy and the teaching to get to the standards can be more creative. It's how you get to the standards. How do you get those outcomes that are more important than the inputs? What it really falls down to is it hits the English language literacy standards and the math standards. And those have been revised
yes.
to have students doing more stuff. I like the part about students doing more stuff than having stuff done to them. I think that's how they learn.
And I'm certainly picking up on that, too, that schools are doing more applied learning
yes.
and less of what we've had before.
Right, the rote
knowledge.
Drill.
Rote
yeah,
knowledge.
Very, very good. So that particular theme makes it an interesting day for a teacher or a curriculum person in the regard that you're trying to figure out how to move these pieces forward, where it's become a political football, and I think it is actually a very legitimate political football, is again about, well, so why do states have to do this, or why do the states had to do it because, frankly, the Department of Education said if you want an NCLB waiver, you have to adopt Common Core standards. That is demonstrably true, and it is a trope of perhaps the right wing that keeps bringing this up, and it is accurate that it was kind of sort of coerced
yes.
on states to accept these standards. So you
yes.
have to give fealty to this issue. At the same time, it's not a federal creation. It's clearly there were educators that were involved
yes.
with it, although educators have also had a beef with them too, because sometimes they don't see them as very practical for the needs of the students in the classroom that may or may not have those dispositions, knowledge, and skills to be able to get to that standard. I have a very nuanced view of it, which is that I've seen it in practice, and some folks have gotten rid of Common Core. But they're pretty much doing what the Common Core idea is. Like, for example, Indiana, they've officially gotten rid of it. And, of course, Governor Walker and the legislature here has been opposed kind of to Common Core. Walker has been sort of hard to read in that regard. You brought up earlier in a previous conversation about, for example, two of the presidential candidates, Jeb Bush, who's for the Common Core, Marco Rubio, who's opposed to the Common Core. It's become a political football, which is a bit of a distraction of,
yes.
of what's actually happening in the schools. And the general consensus among educators is high standards, and that this is still one part of that, but there are some issues that need to be tweaked and worked on.
Right. Okay. That's Common Core where it is. And I think we've talked a little bit about they're cropping up now in these political discussions that we're having these days by our presidential candidates. And as you pointed out, Rubio was opposed to them, and Jeb Bush is in favor of them. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens to Common Core. There's got to be standards of some sort,
right.
but what those standards are, then I suppose in ultimately we'll come back to the states, depending on what the federal law is.
I can say two more words about how it cropped up in Wisconsin.
Yes.
I was at a couple of the hearings that were already 2 years ago.
Yes.
And one of the contentions was to scrap the Common Core standards and start anew with a whole set of standards, which had a lot of educators very anxious because they were already in place. There was money allocated, and there was what takes time, which is
yes.
the professional development. My thought was that the schools and teachers are well served most any time they have dedicated professional development where you collaborate, irrespective really of how laborious the standards are, because sometimes standards
and whatever
truly
the product
can be
important. Is whatever
right.
those
but
standards
just that
are.
Collaboration yeah. is really valuable. But there was a I think an extreme view, which was that we'll just create our own standards. But on top of that, there was this notion that it should be a partisan appointed group, which would have meant that those standards could have been. And I would be concerned about any political group that wants to put their standards in and make it a political football every election. That was the thing that needed to be rejected 2 years ago. I think we're in a different place now, but because Common Core standards are generally engaged and involved in most of Wisconsin.
Accepted. Okay. And gives teachers a focus. And I think teachers can only handle so much in terms of the changes that they have to bring about. Otherwise, they really are in a state of confusion, and that doesn't bring about good education, in my opinion, either.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, let's move on. Recently, the high school graduation rate across the country has increased so that now it is over 80%. However, the New York Times had an article in its 12/27/15 issue, December 27/15 issue, suggesting that there is a difference between graduation rate and ability to do college-level work. Interestingly, Joel Schatzky, writing as a follow-up in the Huffington Post on January 2, 2016, suggested that part of this was due to the fact that 15 to 20% of the population have a language-based learning disability, and dyslexia is the most common of these disabilities. And then a second major factor here, according to Schatzky, is that ADHD affects about 19% of high school-age boys, and thus their ability to perform in college. So this whole idea that kids can't perform college-level work, even though we got an 8% graduation level, seems to be demeaning the public schools.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how do you respond to this?
Well, I think it's a very provocative article. What I would say is that if indeed the claims are that we are graduating students that are unprepared for work, that's a significant concern, and we should be looking at that very carefully. I think one of the issues that he brings up about that struck me in this piece about the ADHD is that there's a lot of debate I'm seeing in the special education community about two things. One is the disproportionate number of young African-American males who are diagnosed with that label, and it does seem to be very disproportionate. There's lots of research in that case.
Okay.
I'm also very concerned about the underreported students that really do need the special services.
Yes.
And for probably socioeconomic or sociocultural factors, don't get the attention that they need. So it's a double-edged sword. On the one hand, we know disproportionately we're assigning too many, and I say we, and I'll stand corrected if others can argue this, but there are special education researchers who say disproportionality is an issue, that too many people are being affixed that label.
Uh-huh.
On the other hand, I'm greatly concerned that perhaps at the same time there are others that are not being given the services they need. So that figure, I think, bears more research. I think that there needs to be a closer look at that issue. In terms of learning disabilities and dyslexia, I think one of the positive evolutions, if you will, is in the diagnostic, which is that we know so much more about the brain functions and cognitively.
Yes.
And I think it's very positive that we even have disciplinarily emotional learning standards. That's very important. We have to look at the whole individual, not just the cognitive.
Yes.
I think we're paying much more attention to that now. So if we are diagnosing and finding more, the better. And so what we have to do, though, is if we find that we have disproportionately so many more students in, for example, urban areas that have asthma or many students that are showing, you know, levels of cognitive development, and I would say it's because of poverty.
Yes.
And because of historically, right, we know and many years ago the lead paint and these other environmental factors had much to do with it. But we do know 1 out of 5 kids is largely in poverty, and 1 out of 6, I believe, is homeless.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those are staggering statistics that need to be addressed, because that absolutely will impact their ability to be in school, first of all, attendance, and is part of being, just being there is part of it, and being able to be successful to go on to graduate. So I think underneath this article are a number of claims and suppositions I would like to interrogate further.
Yes.
Because, you know, we've been debating about the graduation rate. The graduation rate, by most measures, is up. We're reporting it better by following cohorts, which had been a significant slippage in how you would report it. Kids drop out in freshman year, but they're not accounted for by senior year as being part of that dropout rate. So I think we're doing better that way in the reportage. But what are these underlying factors telling us? And that needs more interrogation.
Right. Okay. So I'll try to send you those articles from the New York Times and from the Huffington Post. Shotsky, in his Huffington Post article, did make the point that probably more could be done if the schools had the resources to use in terms of working with those kids. Mm-hmm. But many times they simply don't have those resources.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, I want to remind our listeners that this is your host, Dwayne Olson, and you're listening to Education Matters on WGTD HD at 91.1 on your radio dial from Gateway Technical College, Kenosha, Wisconsin. Today, I am visiting with Dr. Todd Allen Price of National Lewis University. We've discussed a variety of current education issues related to American public education. Now back to our discussion. Recently, I have been reading Putnam's book, Our Kids, the American Dream in Crisis. He wrote Bowling Alone that was so popular about 10 years ago. In this new book, Our Kids, the American Dream in Crisis, holds a mirror up to society in which I and those of us over 60 years of age were raised, and compares it to today's society. The society of the late 50s through the early 70s was a society in which rich kids and poor kids went to school together in public schools. All kids benefited from this contact, and upward mobility was an outcome for many, such as myself. However, in today's society, we see a drawing apart of rich kids and poor kids through housing patterns, the decline of the middle class, the end of many good-paying union jobs, and so forth, and thus less social mobility. Putnam sees today's social discrimination as serious as yesterday's racial discrimination. Your thoughts on Putnam's analysis?
Yeah, this is very central to my heart, and I think is the critical thesis of our times. It's the growing inequality. I mean, there's just no doubt, and this is playing out in the presidential campaigns, and should be on the minds of everyone as an American, that it's that growing inequality which wrecks the opportunity to have these common experiences across socioeconomic class lines, if you will. And to your point, we just see that growing. I feel it needs a public national conversation, which is that every student should have an excellent school. Every school should be an excellent school. But it's not just about excellence. It's about equity. It's about the availability of opportunities for, as you just referenced, as a Putnam reference, for poor kids and rich kids to congregate together. That was the whole premise of the common school. That was the whole premise of the neighborhood school, that you would have a school in your neighborhood that all children could go to and that you would be proud of that school. It was never meant to be common, meaning inferior. Common was to be indeed a fine school with a commons where people congregated together. I remain concerned about that, and I don't think the current ESSA addresses that per se. I think that still keeps the door wide open for what has unfortunately been euphemistically called choice, but really means selected enrollment. That's the distinction, is that if some kids can get into the school and other kids can't get into the school, you set up an elitism which follows that child everywhere, in both instances, the rich and the poor kid alike, such that they feel either that they are privileged or this one is a second-class citizen. That doesn't bode well for a democracy, and it's a nagging, to me, a thorn in my side for a long time that we haven't identified that further. I think it's going to continue to be an issue we need to address and embrace, which is how do we create these commons, these spaces? And education is the location where all of these contentious issues
yes.
actually come to the door. And I think that's a good thing, where we can work out our agreements and disagreements as a society. If we don't have that, Dwayne, what do we have except individual tribes? Jonathan Kozol, years ago when I talked to him about this is 20-odd years ago, he warned of this,
yes.
talking about the balkanization of the American society, and warned that under the guise of quote-unquote choice, which we all want choice. Every
yes.
last parent, child, student, teacher wants choice. We're not opposed to choice by saying this. But that we also have an equity and an ethic of doing and collaborating and building a society together. If we don't have that, Dwayne, we do see implications of that in our body politic today, where we have tribes.
And all choices have to be good choices.
They have to be good choices. They have to be real choices.
Yeah,
right?
real choices. Yeah.
And that is so doable. I remain optimistic that that is absolutely within the possibility of this nation, but it's going to include some, as my faculty often talk about it, difficult conversations where we have to embrace the idea that we're going to need to work through how does everybody really have a choice and economic opportunity and viable paths.
And maybe taking another look at desegregation and did we really desegregate, and if so, how well did it work, et cetera, et cetera.
Absolutely. I think that was one of the things that President Obama, when he signed the ESSA, he pointed to, which was that the signing of the ESSA was the Every Student Succeeds Act was intended to maintain that ethic that was set up by Lyndon Baines Johnson, president in the 60s,
yes.
that every child would indeed have the opportunity to go to schools with students that are different from them, and that the country would benefit from that.
Right. Okay, well, I think we're beginning maybe in a sense to see the whole of American culture in terms of where American public education fits into the whole of creating that culture. And as soon as people get cut out, then we have problems.
You know, and you just made me think about it this way, Dwayne, by saying that one of the perhaps almost causal impacts of public education is creating that culture. Public education is with all of its flaws, has this very special location in terms of inculcating some of these values that we hold in high esteem, which is working together.
Yes.
And some of this is going to, whether we want to address it as a society or not, is going to evolve naturally because our demographics are changing. And because we have refugees, we have immigration, we have
yes.
a changing politic, body politic in terms of who are our citizens or who are aspiring to be citizens. So that is indeed going to beg these questions of how do we one of my students yesterday to be said she has 57 languages in her school.
Oh, really?
57 languages.
Oh, yes.
So it begs the question of how do you have a common school and a common curriculum? And I think you should in one capacity,
yes.
working towards a democracy where everyone's enfranchised.
Yeah.
But how do you do that? You can't do it the way we did it 50 years ago when you
no.
have 57 different languages in that school, different parents, different
yeah.
expectations. So we have to think about that because it's arriving at our doorstep.
Yeah. I have a daughter in the St. Paul Public Schools who works in St. Paul Public Schools, and she says they have over 70 different languages, and it's just incredible what public schools are dealing with in terms of language
mm-hmm.
and the English language learning programs that they have to provide as a result of that, not to mention then bringing the cultures together so that
Absolutely.
They understand one another.
Yes, yeah.
You know, another one of the things I've just read recently, too, is that these Syrian refugees coming into Europe and so forth. Denmark apparently has a rule that no school can have more than 20% of its students be these refugees or of a particular group, because what they're doing is seeing the whole culture and wanting to create these new kids as part of the whole culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really admiring that.
There's fascinating responses. As I'd mentioned to you before, I was in Turkey at the University of Çukurova, and I met several of these students coming right over the border in one of the East Adana schools. The Turkey is doing yeoman's work. They're doing wonderful, and I don't know that this is really understood in this country, actually, but they're taking in 2 million refugees, which is just staggering when you think about how you're trying to respond with an infrastructure. They're taking these kids and these parents and these teachers that are coming from destroyed homes, destroyed villages, and putting them right into schools, and it just moved me greatly to see that up front and personal, to be able to speak in some of these classrooms where some of the schools I visited. And we in the United States have to shoulder the burden of this as well. We need to step up to this and not wait or react by closing the borders, but we're going to have to think anew about who is our public education student, because that face of the public education student is evolving and changing, and we have to evolve with it and think about how we can do well. And I think we can. I think that even the students that are coming from these incredible situations are able to persevere and thrive under a safe school and excellent teachers.
And what one of the things that we haven't done yet is given these Syrian kids and these refugee kids the opportunity to come to the United States. So Turkey and many of the European countries have really stepped forward in terms of this.
Absolutely.
And we have done so little in terms of responding to this international need that we
Absolutely.
Have.
Right. Absolutely.
We're running short on time now, Todd. So is there maybe another little topic that you'd like to talk about and to bring things to closure?
Well, there's one really big topic that's happening in Illinois,
okay.
And I'm interested in how it's playing out in Wisconsin, but it's called the EdTPA, which is a teacher performance assessment. And that is going to be probably fodder for another show that we
yes.
can talk about in the future. But that is how teacher education candidates are being appraised. And it's very interesting because it's sort of like the Common Core, where these particular standards that they're to meet, but it also is very onerous and heavy and in terms of all of the things that our teacher candidates have to do to get
yes.
prepared to be able to just to set foot in the classroom. So that might be for another day, but I think that hopefully for our viewers, they should really come away with realizing that teachers are being heavily scrutinized and given so much work to do.
Yes.
To become a teacher is not an easy job.
No.
It is absolutely a challenging and ideally rewarding, but it is tough. It is a tough job.
Does Illinois have this professional educational development like Wisconsin does, so that these teachers have to prepare these portfolios?
That's exactly what EdTPA is. Yes.
So Illinois has the same thing?
Illinois has the same thing. The difference is that in Illinois, it's very consequential. And such that if you do not pass this EdTPA, you don't go on to teach. You're not a teacher of record. And it's controversial for a number of issues, but ones that I think we'll have to dwell on in another full meeting.
Okay. Thank you ever so much, then. To our radio audience, we say thank you for being with us today as we visit with our guest, Dr. Todd Allen Price, Director of Policy Studies and Educational Foundations and Inquiry Programs Coordinator at the Wheeling, Illinois campus of National Lewis University. And thank you, Professor Price, for joining me in this most important discussion of contemporary education issues. I wish you well in your most important work, preparing teachers, administrators, and other school staff for our schools, particularly our urban schools. Finally, tune in next Saturday at 10:30 a.m. for another edition of Education Matters. This is your host, Wayne Olson, thanking you for being with us today.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard each Saturday morning at 10:30 on WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archive programs are available on our website, WGTD.org, and you're invited to continue the discussion on the Education Matters Facebook page.
Support for classical music on WGTD comes from Piasecki Althaus, honoring personal legacies in the circle of life. They believe that every detail counts and every memory matters. Piasecki Althaus is located in Kenosha on 39th Avenue, serving the community since 1931. Support comes from Gateway Technical College, indispensable and in demand. Be that person with an administrative professional degree. Classroom and real-world experience. Learn online or in the classroom. Median starting salary, $31,000. Information at gtc.edu.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the Polar Plunge for the Special Olympics will take place on Saturday, February 6th. It takes place at the Brat Stop in Kenosha from noon to 5. The Brat Stop is located just west of the interstate on Highway 50 in Kenosha.
WGTD's Morning Show. Insightful questions put each week.